This is Audible.
Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Graveyard Shift and other stories from Night Shift by Stephen King. Graveyard Shift. 2 a.m., Friday. Hall was sitting on the bench by the elevator, the only place on the third floor where a working Joe could catch a smoke, when Warwick came up. He wasn't happy to see Warwick. The foreman wasn't supposed to show up on 3 during the graveyard shift. He was supposed to stay down in his office in the basement drinking coffee from the urn that stood on the corner of his desk. Besides, it was hot. It was the hottest June on record in Gates Falls, and the orange crush thermometer, which was also by the elevator, had once rested at 94 degrees at 3 in the morning. God only knew what kind of hellhole the mill was on the 3 to 11 shift. Hall worked the picker machine, a balky gadget manufactured by a defunct Cleveland firm in 1934. He'd only been working in the mill since April, which meant he was still making minimum $1.78 an hour, which was still all right. No wife, no steady girl, no alimony. He was a drifter, and during the last 3 years he had moved on his thumb from Berkeley, college student, to Lake Tahoe, busboy, to Galveston, stevedore, to Miami, short-order cook, to Wheeling, taxi driver and dishwasher, to Gates Falls, Maine, picker machine operator. He didn't figure on moving again until the snow fell. He was a solitary person, and he liked the hours from 11 to 7 when the blood flow of the big mill was at its coolest, not to mention the temperature. The only thing he did not like was the rats. The third floor was long and deserted, lit only by the sputtering glow of the fluorescence. Unlike the other levels of the mill, it was relatively silent and unoccupied, at least by the humans. The rats were another matter. The only machine on 3 was the picker. The rest of the floor was storage for the 90-pound bags of fiber which had yet to be sorted by Hall's long, gear-toothed machine. They were stacked like link sausages in long rows. Some of them, especially the discontinued Meltons and irregular Slipes for which there were no orders, years old and dirty gray with industrial wastes. They made fine nesting places for the rats, huge, fat-bellied creatures with rabid eyes and bodies that jumped with lice and vermin. Hall had developed a habit of collecting a small arsenal of soft drink cans from the trash barrel during his break. He pegged them at the rats during times when work was slow, retrieving them later at his leisure. Only this time, Mr. Foreman had caught him coming up the stairs instead of using the elevator like the sneaky son of a bitch everyone said he was. "What are you up to, Hall?" "The rats," Hall said, realizing how lame that must sound now that all the rats had snuggled safely back into their houses. "I peg cans at 'em when I see 'em." Warwick nodded once, briefly. He was a big, beefy man with a crew cut. His shirt sleeves were rolled up and his tie was pulled down. He looked at Hall closely. "We don't pay you to chuck cans at rats, mister, not even if you pick 'em up again." "Harry hadn't sent down an order for 20 minutes, Hall answered, thinking, "Why couldn't you stay the hell put and drink your coffee?" "I can't run it through the picker if I don't have it." Warwick nodded as if the topic no longer interested him. "Maybe I'll take a walk up and see Wisconsky," he said. 5 to 1, he's reading a magazine while the crap piles up in his bins." Hall didn't say anything. Warwick suddenly pointed. "There's one! Get the bastard!" Hall fired the knee-high can he'd been holding with one whistling overhand motion. The rat, which had been watching them from atop one of the fabric bags with its bright buckshot eyes, fled with one faint squeak. Warwick threw back his head and laughed as Hall went after the can. "I came to see about something else," Warwick said. "Is that so?" "Next week's 4th of July week." Hall nodded. The mill would be shut down Monday to Saturday, vacation week for men with at least 1 year's tenure. layoff week for men with less than a year.
You want to work?
Hall shrugged. Doing what?
We're going to clean the whole basement level. Nobody's touched it for 12 years. Hell of a mess. We're going to use hoses.
The town zoning committee getting on the board of directors? Warwick looked steadily at Hall.
You want it or not? 2 an hour, double time on the fourth. We're working the graveyard shift because it'll be cooler.
Hall calculated. He could clear maybe $75 after taxes. Better than the goose egg he'd been looking forward to.
All right. Report down by the dye house next Monday.
Hall watched him as he started back to the stairs. Warwick paused halfway there and turned back to look at Hall.
You used to be a college boy, didn't you?
Hall nodded.
Okay, college boy. I'm keeping it in mind.
He left. Hall sat down and lit another smoke, holding a soda can in one hand and watching for the rats. He could just imagine how it would be in the basement, the sub-basement, actually, a level below the dye house, damp, dark, full of spiders and rotten cloth and ooze from the river, and rats. Maybe even bats, the aviators of the rodent family.
Gah!
Hall threw the can hard, then smiled thinly to himself as the faint sound of Warwick's voice came down through the overhead ducts reading Harry Wisconsky the Riot Act. Okay, college boy, I'm keeping it in mind. He stopped smiling abruptly and butted his smoke. A few moments later, Wisconsky started to send rough nylon down through the blowers and Hall went to work. And after a while, the rats came out and sat atop the bags at the back of the long room, watching him with their unblinking black eyes. They looked like a jury. 11 p.m., Monday. There were about 36 men sitting around when Warwick came in wearing a pair of old jeans tucked into high rubber boots. Hall had been listening to Harry Wisconsky, who was enormously fat, enormously lazy, and enormously gloomy.
It's gonna be a mess, Wisconsky was saying when Mr. Foreman came in. You wait and see, we're all gonna go home blacker than midnight in Persia.
Okay, Warwick said. We've strung 60 light bulbs down there, so it should be bright enough for you to see what you're doing. You guys,
he pointed to a bunch of men that had been leaning against the drying spools.
I want you to hook up the hoses over there to the main water conduit by the stairwell. You can unroll them down the stairs. We got about 80 yards for each man, and that should be plenty. Don't get cute and spray one of your buddies, or you'll send him to the hospital. They pack a wallop.
Somebody'll get hurt, Wisconsky prophesied sourly. Wait and see.
And you other guys, Warwick said, pointing to the group that Hall and Wisconsky were a part of. You're the crap crew tonight. You go in pairs with an electric wagon for each team. There's old office furniture, bags of cloth, hunks of busted machinery, you name it. We're going to pile it by the air shaft at the west end. Anyone who doesn't know how to run a wagon?
No one raised a hand. The electric wagons were battery-driven contraptions like miniature dump trucks. They developed a nauseating stink after continual use that reminded Hall of burning power lines.
Okay, Warwick said. We got the basement divided up into sections, and we'll be done by Thursday. Friday, we'll chain hoist the crap out. Questions?
There were none. Hall studied the foreman's face closely, and he had a sudden premonition of a strange thing coming. The idea pleased him. He did not like Warwick very much.
Fine, Warwick said. Let's get at it.
Two a.m., Tuesday. Hall was bushed and very tired of listening to Wisconsky's steady patter of profane complaints. He wondered if it would do any good to belt Wisconsky. He doubted it. It would just give Wisconsky something else to bitch about. Hall had known it would be bad, but this was murder. For one thing, he hadn't anticipated the smell. The polluted stink of the river mixed with the odor of decaying fabric, rotting masonry, vegetable matter. In the far corner where they had begun, Hall discovered a colony of huge white toadstools poking their way up through the shattered cement. His hands had come in contact with them as he pulled and yanked at a rusty gear-toothed wheel, and they felt curiously warm and bloated, like the flesh of a man afflicted with dropsy. The bulbs couldn't banish the 12-year darkness. It could only push it back a little and cast a sickly yellow glow over the whole mess. The place looked like the shattered nave of a desecrated church with its high ceiling and mammoth discarded machinery that they would never be able to move, its wet walls overgrown with patches of yellow moss, and the atonal choir that was the water from the hoses running in the half-clogged sewer network that eventually emptied into the river below the falls. And the rats, huge ones that made those on third look like dwarfs. God knew what they were eating down here. They were continually overturning boards and bags to reveal huge nests of shredded newspaper, watching with atavistic loathing as the pups fled into the cracks and crannies, their eyes huge and blind with the continuous darkness.
"Let's stop for a smoke," Wisconsky said.
He sounded out of breath, but Hall had no idea why. He'd been gold-bricking all night. Still, it was about that time, and they were currently out of sight of everyone else.
"All right."
He leaned against the edge of the electric wagon and lit up.
"I should never have let Warwick talk me into this," Wisconsky said dolefully. "This ain't work for a man. But he was mad the other night when he caught me in the crapper up on four with my pants up. Christ, was he mad!"
Hall said nothing. He was thinking about Warwick and about the rats. Strange how the two things seemed tied together. The rats seemed to have forgotten all about men in their long stay under the mill. They were impudent and hardly afraid at all. One of them had sat up on its hind legs like a squirrel until Hall had gotten it kicking distance, and then it had launched itself at his boot, biting at the leather. Hundreds, maybe thousands. He wondered how many varieties of disease they were carrying around in this black sump hole. And Warwick. Something about him.
"I need the money," Wisconsky said, "but Christ, Jesus, buddy, this ain't no work for a man. Those rats."
He looked around fearfully.
"It almost seems like they think. You ever wonder how it'd be if we was little and they were big?"
"Oh, shut up," Hall said. Wisconsky looked at him, wounded.
"Say, I'm sorry, buddy. It's just that..."
He trailed off.
"Jesus, this place stinks," he cried. "This ain't no kind of work for a man."
A spider crawled off the edge of the wagon and scrambled up his arm. He brushed it off with a choke sound of disgust.
"Come on," Hall said, snuffing his cigarette. "The faster, the quicker." "I suppose," Wisconsky said miserably. "I suppose."
Four a.m., Tuesday. Lunchtime. Hall and Wisconsky sat with three or four other men eating their sandwiches with black hands that not even the industrial detergent could clean. Hall ate looking into the foreman's little glass office. Warwick was drinking coffee and eating cold hamburgers with great relish.
"Ray Upson had to go home," Charlie Brochu said.
"He puke?" someone asked. "I almost did."
"Nah. Ray'd eat cowflop before he'd puke. Rat bit him."
Hall looked up thoughtfully from his examination of Warwick.
"Is that so?" he asked.
"Yeah," Brochu shook his head. "I was teaming with him. God damnedest thing I ever saw. Jumped out of a hole in one of those old cloth bags. Must have been big as a cat. Grabbed onto his hand and started chewing."
"Jesus," one of the men said, looking green.
"Yeah," Brochu said. "Ray screamed just like a woman, and I ain't blaming him. He bled like a pig.
Would that thing let go? No, sir. I had to belt it 3 or 4 times with a board before it would. Ray was just about crazy. He stomped it until it wasn't nothing but a mess of fur. Damnedest thing I ever saw. Warwick put a bandage on him and sent him home. Told him to go to the doctor tomorrow. That was big of the bastard, somebody said. As if he had heard, Warwick got to his feet in his office, stretched, and then came to the door.
Time we got back with it.
The men got to their feet slowly, eating up all the time they possibly could, stowing their dinner buckets, getting cold drinks, buying candy bars. Then they started down, heels clanking dispiritedly on the steel grillwork of the stair risers. Warwick passed Hall, clapping him on the shoulder.
How's it going, college boy?
He didn't wait for an answer.
Come on, Hall said patiently to Wisconsky, who was tying his shoelace. They went downstairs.
Seven a.m., Tuesday. Hall and Wisconsky walked out together. It seemed to Hall that he had somehow inherited the fat pole. Wisconsky was almost comically dirty, his fat moon face smeared like that of a small boy who had just been thrashed by the town bully. There was none of the usual rough banter from the other men, the pulling of shirt tails, the cracks about who was keeping Tony's wife warm between the hours of 1 and 4. Nothing but silence and an occasional hawking sound as someone spat on the dirty floor.
You want a lift? Wisconsky asked him hesitantly.
Thanks. They didn't talk as they rode up Mill Street and crossed the bridge. They exchanged only a brief word when Wisconsky dropped him off in front of his apartment. Hall went directly to the shower, still thinking about Warwick, trying to place whatever it was about Mr. Foreman that drew him, made him feel that somehow they had become tied together. He slept as soon as his head hit the pillow, but his sleep was broken and restless. He dreamed of rats. 1 a.m., Wednesday. It was better running the hoses. They couldn't go in until the crap crews had finished a section, and quite often they were done hosing before the next section was clear, which meant time for a cigarette. Hall worked the nozzle of one of the long hoses, and Wisconsky pattered back and forth, unsnagging lengths of the hose, turning the water on and off, moving obstructions. Warwick was short-tempered because the work was proceeding slowly. They would never be done by Thursday, the way things were going. Now they were working on a helter-skelter jumble of 19th-century office equipment that had been piled in one corner. Smashed roll-top desks, moldy ledgers, reams of invoices, chairs with broken seats. And it was rat heaven. Scores of them squeaked and ran through the dark and crazy passages that honeycombed the heap, and after 2 men were bitten, the others refused to work until Warwick sent someone upstairs to get heavy rubberized gloves, the kind usually reserved for the dyehouse crew, which had to work with acids. Hall and Wisconsky were waiting to go in with their hoses when a sandy-haired bullneck named Carmichael began howling curses and backing away, slapping at his chest with his gloved hands. A huge rat with gray-streaked fur and ugly, glaring eyes had bitten into his shirt and hung there, squeaking and kicking at Carmichael's belly with its back paws. Carmichael finally knocked it away with his fist, but there was a huge hole in his shirt, and a thin line of blood trickled from above one nipple. The anger faded from his face. He turned away and retched. Hall turned the hose on the rat, which was old and moving slowly, a snatch of Carmichael's shirt still caught in its jaws. The roaring pressure drove it backward against the wall where it smashed limply. Warwick came over, an odd, strained smile on his lips. He clapped Hall on the shoulder.
"Damn sight better than throwing cans at the little bastards, huh, college boy?"
"Some little bastard," Wisconsky said. "It's a foot long."
"Turn that hose over there," Warwick pointed at the jumble of furniture. "You guys, get out of the way."
"With pleasure," someone muttered. Carmichael charged up to Warwick, his face sick and twisted.
"I'm gonna have compensation for this. I'm gonna..."
"Sure,"
Warwick said, smiling. You got bit on the titty. Get out of the way before you get pasted down by this water.
Hall pointed the nozzle and let it go. It hit with a white explosion of spray, knocking over a desk and smashing two chairs to splinters. Rats ran everywhere, bigger than any Hall had ever seen. He could hear men crying out in disgust and horror as they fled, things with huge eyes and sleek, plump bodies. He caught a glimpse of one that looked as big as a healthy 6-week puppy. He kept on until he could see no more, then shut the nozzle down.
Okay, Warwick called. Let's pick it up.
I didn't hire out as no exterminator, Cy Ipperston called mutinously. Hall had tipped a few with him the week before. He was a young guy wearing a smut-stained baseball cap and a T-shirt.
That you, Ipperston? Warwick asked genially.
Ipperston looked uncertain but stepped forward.
Yeah, I don't want no more of these rats. I hired to clean up, not to maybe get rabies or typhoid or something. Maybe you best count me out.
There was a murmur of agreement from the others. Wiskonski stole a look at Hall, but Hall was examining the nozzle of the hose he was holding. It had a bore like a 45 and could probably knock a man 20 feet.
You saying you want to punch your clock, Cy?
Thinking about it, Ipperston said. Warwick nodded.
Okay, you and anybody else that wants. But this ain't no unionized shop and never has been. Punch out now, and you'll never punch back in. I'll see to it.
Aren't you some hot ticket, Hall muttered.
Warwick swung around.
Did you say something, college boy?
Hall regarded him blandly. Just clearing my throat, Mr. Foreman. Warwick smiled.
Something taste bad to you?
Hall said nothing.
All right, let's pick it up, Warwick bawled.
They went back to work.
2 a.m., Thursday. Hall and Wiskonski were working with the trucks again, picking up junk. The pile by the west air shaft had grown to amazing proportions, but they were still not half done.
Happy Fourth, Wiskonski said when they stopped for a smoke.
They were working near the north wall, far from the stairs. The light was extremely dim, and some trick of acoustics made the other men seem miles away.
Thanks,
Hall dragged on his smoke. Haven't seen many rats tonight.
Nobody has, Wiskonski said. Maybe they got wise.
They were standing at the end of a crazy zigzagging alley formed by piles of old ledgers and invoices, moldy bags of cloth, and two huge flat looms of ancient vintage.
Gah, Wiskonski said, spitting. That Warwick.
Where do you suppose all the rats got to? Hall asked, almost to himself. Not into the walls. He looked at the wet and crumbling masonry that surrounded the huge foundation stones. They'd drown. The river saturated everything. Something black and flapping suddenly dive-bombed them. Wiskonski screamed and put his hands over his head. A bat, Hall said, watching after it as Wiskonski straightened up.
A bat? A bat, Wiskonski raved. What's a bat doing in the cellar? They're supposed to be in trees and under eaves and...
It was a big one, Hall said softly. And what's a bat but a rat with wings?
Jesus, Wiskonski moaned. How did it...
get in? Maybe the same way the rats got out.
What's going on back there?
Warwick shouted from somewhere behind them.
Where are you?
Don't sweat it, Hall said softly. His eyes gleamed in the dark.
Was that you, college boy?
Warwick called. He sounded closer.
It's okay, Hall yelled. I barked my shin.
Warwick's short, barking laugh.
You want a purple heart?
Wiskonski looked at Hall.
Why'd you say that?
Look. Hall knelt and lit a match. There was a square in the middle of the wet and crumbling cement. Tap it. Wiskonski did.
It's wood.
Hall nodded. It's the top of a support. I've seen some other ones around here. There's another level under this part of the basement.
God, Wiskonski said with utter revulsion.
3:30 a.m., Thursday. They were in the northeast corner, Ippiston and Broshu behind them with one of the high-pressure hoses, when Hall stopped and pointed at the floor.
There, I thought we'd come across it. There was a wooden trap door with a crusted iron ring bolt set near the center. He walked back to Ippiston and said, "Shut it off for a minute." When the hose was choked to a trickle, he raised his voice to a shout.
"Hey! Hey! Warwick! Better come here a minute!"
Warwick came splashing over, looking at Hall with that same hard smile in his eyes.
"Your shoelace come untied, college boy?"
"Look," Hall said. He kicked the trapdoor with his foot. "Sub-cellar."
"So what?" Warwick asked. "This isn't break time,
"That's where your rats are," Hall said. "They're breeding down there. Wiskonski and I even saw a bat earlier." Some of the other men had gathered around and were looking at the trapdoor.
"I don't care," Warwick said. "The job was the basement, not..."
"You'll need about 20 exterminators, trained ones," Hall was saying. "Going to cost the management a pretty penny."
"Too bad."
Someone laughed.
"Fat chance."
Warwick looked at Hall as if he were a bug under glass.
"You're really a case, you are," he said, sounding fascinated. "Do you think I give a good goddamn how many rats there are under there?"
"I was at the library this afternoon and yesterday," Hall said. "Good thing you kept reminding me I was a college boy. I read the town zoning ordinances, Warwick. They were set up in 1911, before this mill got big enough to co-op the zoning board."
"Know what I found?"
Warwick's eyes were cold.
"Take a walk, college boy. You're fired."
"I found out," Hall plowed on as if he hadn't heard, "I found out that there is a zoning law in Gates Falls about vermin. You spell that V-E-R-M-I-N, in case you wondered. It means disease-carrying animals such as bats, skunks, unlicensed dogs, and rats. Especially rats. Rats are mentioned 14 times in 2 paragraphs, Mr. Foreman. So you just keep in mind that the minute I punch out, I'm going straight to the town commissioner and tell him what the situation down here is." He paused, relishing Warwick's hate-congested face. "I think that between me, him, and the town committee, we can get an injunction slapped on this place. You're going to be shut down a lot longer than just Saturday, Mr. Foreman. And I got a good idea what your boss is going to say when he turns up. Hope your unemployment insurance is paid up, Warwick." Warwick's hands formed into claws.
"You damn snot-nose, I oughta..."
He looked down at the trap door, and suddenly his smile reappeared.
"Consider yourself rehired, college boy."
"I thought you might see the light." Warwick nodded, the same strange grin on his face.
"You're just so smart. I think maybe you ought to go down there, Hall, so we got somebody with a college education to give us an informed opinion. You and Wiskonski."
"Not me,"
Wiskonski exclaimed.
"Not me, I..."
Warwick looked at him.
"You what?"
Wiskonski shut up.
"Good," Hall said cheerfully. "We'll need 3 flashlights. I think I saw a whole rack of those 6 battery jobs in the main office, didn't I?"
"You want to take somebody else?"
Warwick asked expansively.
"Sure. Pick your man."
"You," Hall said gently. The strange expression had come into his face again. After all, the management should be represented, don't you think? just so Wisconsky and I don't see too many rats down there. Someone, it sounded like Ippiston, laughed loudly. Warwick looked at the men carefully. They studied the tips of their shoes. Finally, he pointed at Brochu.
Brochu, go up to the office and get 3 flashlights. Tell the watchman I said to let you in.
Why'd you get me into this? Wisconsky moaned to Hall. You know I hate those...
It wasn't me, Hall said, and looked at Warwick. Warwick looked back at him, and neither would drop his eyes. 4 a.m., Thursday. Brochu returned with the flashlights. He gave 1 to Hall, 1 to Wisconsky, 1 to Warwick.
Ippiston, give the hose to Wisconsky.
Ippiston did so. The nozzle trembled delicately between the Pole's hands.
All right, Warwick said to Wisconsky. You're in the middle. If there are rats, you let them have it.
Sure, Hall thought. And if there are rats, Warwick won't see them. And neither will Wisconsky after he finds an extra 10 in his pay envelope. Warwick pointed at 2 of the men.
Lift it!
One of them bent over the ring bolt and pulled. For a moment, Hall didn't think it was going to give, and then it yanked free with an odd, crunching snap. The other man put his fingers on the underside to help pull, then withdrew with a cry. His hands were crawling with huge and sightless beetles. With a convulsive grunt, the man on the ring bolt pulled the trap back and let it drop. The underside was black with an odd fungus that Hall had never seen before. The beetles dropped off into the darkness below or ran across the floor to be crushed. Look, Hall said. There was a rusty lock bolted on the underside, now broken.
But it shouldn't be underneath, Warwick said. It should be on top. Why?
Lots of reasons, Hall said. Maybe so nothing on this side could open it, at least when the lock was new. Maybe so nothing on that side could get up.
But who locked it?
Wisconsky asked. Ah, Hall said mockingly, looking at Warwick. A mystery.
Listen, Brochu whispered.
Oh, God, Wisconsky sobbed. I ain't going down there.
It was a soft sound, almost expectant. The whisk and patter of thousands of paws, the squeaking of rats.
Could be frogs, Warwick said.
Hall laughed aloud. Warwick shone his light down. A sagging flight of wooden stairs led down to the black stones of the floor beneath. There was not a rat in sight.
Those stairs won't hold us, Warwick said with finality.
Brochu took 2 steps forward and jumped up and down on the first step. It creaked, but showed no sign of giving way.
I didn't ask you to do that, Warwick said.
You weren't there when that rat bit Ray, Brochu said softly.
Let's go, Hall said. Warwick took a last sardonic look around at the circle of men, then walked to the edge with Hall. Wisconsky stepped reluctantly between them. They went down 1 at a time. Hall, then Wisconsky, then Warwick. Their flashlight beams played over the floor, which was twisted and heaved into 100 crazy hills and valleys. The hose thumped along behind Wisconsky like a clumsy serpent. When they got to the bottom, Warwick flashed his light around. It picked out a few rotting boxes, some barrels, little else. The seep from the river stood in puddles that came to ankle depth on their boots.
I don't hear them anymore, Wisconsky whispered.
They walked slowly away from the trap door, their feet shuffling through the slime. Hall paused and shone his light on a huge wooden box with white letters on it. Elias Varney, he read. 1841. Was the mill here then?
No, Warwick said. It wasn't built until 1897. What difference?
Hall didn't answer. They walked forward again. The sub-cellar was longer than it should have been, it seemed. The stench was stronger, a smell of decay and rot and things buried. And still the only sound was the faint, cave-like drip of water.
"What's that?" Hall asked, pointing his beam at a jut of concrete that protruded perhaps 2 feet into the cellar.
Beyond it, the darkness continued, and it seemed to Hall that he could now hear sounds up there, curiously stealthy. Warwick peered at it.
"It's... no, that can't be right.
Outer wall of the mill, isn't it? And up ahead..."
"I'm going back," Warwick said, suddenly turning around.
Hall grabbed his neck roughly.
"You're not going anywhere, Mr. Foreman."
Warwick looked up at him, his grin cutting the darkness.
"You're crazy, college boy. Isn't that right? Crazy as a loon."
"You shouldn't push people, friend. Keep going." Wisconsky moaned.
"Hall?"
"Give me that."
Hall grabbed the hose. He let go of Warwick's neck and pointed the hose at his head. Wisconsky turned abruptly and crashed back toward the trapdoor. Hall did not even turn.
"After you, Mr. Foreman."
Warwick stepped forward, walking under the place where the mill ended above them. Hall flashed his light about and felt a cold satisfaction. Premonition fulfilled. The rats had closed in around them, silent as death. Crowded in, rank on rank. Thousands of eyes looked greedily back at him, in ranks to the wall, some fully as high as a man's shin. Warwick saw them a moment later and came to a full stop.
"They're all around us, college boy."
His voice was still calm, still in control, but it held a jagged edge.
"Yes," Hall said. "Keep going."
They walked forward, the hose dragging behind. Hall looked back once and saw the rats had closed the aisle behind them and were gnawing at the heavy canvas hosing. One looked up and almost seemed to grin at him before lowering his head again. He could see the bats now, too. They were roosting from the rough-hewn overheads, huge, the size of crows or rooks.
"Look," Warwick said, centering his beam about 5 feet ahead.
A skull, green with mold, laughed up at them. Further on, Hall could see an ulna, one pelvic wing, part of a rib cage.
"Keep going," Hall said.
He felt something bursting up inside him, something lunatic and dark with colors.
"You are going to break before I do, Mr. Foreman. So help me God."
They walked past the bones. The rats were not crowding them. Their distances appeared constant. Up ahead, Haw saw one cross their path of travel. Shadows hid it, but he caught sight of a pink twitching tail as thick as a telephone cord. Up ahead, the flooring rose sharply, then dipped. Haw could hear a stealthy rustling sound. A big sound. Something that perhaps no living man had ever seen. It occurred to Hall that he had perhaps been looking for something like this through all his days of crazy wandering. The rats were moving in, creeping on their bellies, forcing them forward.
"Look," Warwick said coldly.
Hall saw. Something had happened to the rats back here, some hideous mutation that never could have survived under the eye of the sun. Nature would have forbidden it. But down here, nature had taken on another ghastly face. The rats were gigantic, some as high as 3 feet. But their rear legs were gone and they were blind as moles, like their flying cousins. They dragged themselves forward with hideous eagerness. Warwick turned and faced Hall, the smile hanging on by brute willpower. Hall really had to admire him.
"We can't go on, Hall. You must see that."
"The rats have business with you, I think," Hall said. Warwick's control slipped.
Please, he said. Please.
Hall smiled.
Keep going.
Warwick was looking over his shoulder.
They're gnawing into the hose. When they get through it, we'll never get back.
I know. Keep going.
You're insane.
A rat ran across Warwick's shoe and he screamed. Hall smiled and gestured with his light. They were all around, the closest of them less than a foot away now. Warwick began to walk again. The rats drew back. They topped the miniature rise and looked down. Warwick reached it first, and Hall saw his face go white as paper. Spit ran down his chin.
Oh, my God! Dear Jesus!
And he turned to run. Hall opened the nozzle of the hose, and the high-pressure rush of water struck Warwick squarely on the chest, knocking him back out of sight. There was a long scream that rose over the sound of the water. Thrashing sounds!
Hall!
Grunts. A huge, tenebrous squeaking that seemed to fill the earth.
Hall! For God's sake!
A sudden, wet, ripping noise. Another scream, weaker. Something huge shifted and turned. Quite distinctly, Hall heard the wet snap that a fractured bone makes. A legless rat, guided by some bastard form of sonar, lunged against him, biting. Its body was flabby, warm. Almost absently, Hall turned the hose on it, knocking it away. The hose did not have quite so much pressure now. Hall walked to the brow of the wet hill and looked down. The rat filled the whole gully at the far end of that noxious tomb. It was a huge and pulsating gray, eyeless, totally without legs. When Hall's light struck it, it made a hideous mewling noise. Their queen, then, the Magna Mater, a huge and nameless thing whose progeny might someday develop wings. It seemed to dwarf what remained of Warwick, but that was probably just illusion. It was the shock of seeing a rat as big as a Holstein calf. Goodbye, Warwick, Hall said. The rat crouched over Mr. Foreman jealously, ripping at one limp arm. Hall turned away and began to make his way back rapidly, halting the rats with his hose, which was growing less and less potent. Some of them got through and attacked his legs above the tops of his boots with biting lunges. One hung stubbornly on at his thigh, ripping at the cloth of his corduroy pants. Hall made a fist and smashed it aside. He was nearly three-quarters of the way back when the huge whirring filled the darkness. He looked up, and the gigantic flying form smashed into his face. The mutated bats had not lost their tails yet. It whipped around Hall's neck in a loathsome coil and squeezed as the teeth sought the soft spot under his neck. It wriggled and flapped with its membranous wings, clutching the tatters of his shirt for purchase. Hall brought the nozzle of the hose up blindly and struck at its yielding body again and again. It fell away, and he trampled it beneath his feet, dimly aware that he was screaming. The rats ran in a flood over his feet, up his legs. He broke into a staggering run, shaking some off. The others bit at his belly, his chest. One ran up his shoulder and pressed its questing muzzle into the cup of his ear. He ran into the second bat. It roosted on his head for a moment, squealing, and then ripped away a flap of Hall's scalp. He felt his body growing numb. His ears filled with the screech and yammer of many rats. He gave one last heave, stumbled over furry bodies, fell to his knees. He began to laugh. A high, screaming sound.
5 a.m., Thursday. Somebody better go down there, Brochu said tentatively.
Not me, Wisconsky whispered. Not me.
No, not you, Jelly Belly, Ippiston said with contempt. Well, let's go, Brogan said, bringing up another hose. Me? Ippiston? Dangerfield? Nadeau?
Stevenson, go up to the office and get a few more lights.
Ippiston looked down into the darkness thoughtfully. Maybe they stopped for a smoke, he said. A few rats? What the hell?
Stevenson came back with the lights. A few moments later, they started down.
The Man Who Loved Flowers. On an early evening in May of 1963, a young man with his hand in his pocket walked briskly up New York's Third Avenue. The air was soft and beautiful. The sky was darkening by slow degrees from blue to the calm and lovely violet of dusk. There are people who love the city, and this was one of the nights that made them love it. Everyone standing in the doorways of the delicatessens and dry cleaning shops and restaurants seemed to be smiling. An old lady pushing two bags of groceries and an old baby pram grinned at the young man and hailed him.
Hey, beautiful!
The young man gave her a half smile and raised his hand in a wave. She passed on her way thinking, he's in love. He had that look about him. He was dressed in a light gray suit, the narrow tie pulled down a little, his top collar button undone. His hair was dark and cut short. His complexion was fair, his eyes a light blue. Not an extraordinary face, but on this soft spring evening, on this avenue, in May of 1963, he was beautiful. And the old woman found herself thinking with a moment's sweet nostalgia that in spring, anyone can be beautiful, if they're hurrying to meet the one of their dreams for dinner and maybe dancing after. Spring is the only season when nostalgia never seems to turn bitter, and she went on her way glad she had spoken to him, and glad he had returned the compliment by raising his hand in half salute. The young man crossed 63rd Street, walking with a bounce in his step and that same half smile on his lips. Partway up the block, an old man stood beside a chipped green hand cart filled with flowers. The predominant color was yellow, a yellow fever of jonquils and late crocuses. The old man also had carnations and a few hothouse tea roses, mostly yellow and white. He was eating a pretzel and listening to a bulky transistor radio that was sitting kitty-corner on his hand cart. The radio poured out bad news that no one listened to. A hammer murderer was still on the loose. JFK had declared that the situation in a little Asian country called Vietnam, Vietnam, the guy reading the news called it, would bear watching. An unidentified woman had been pulled from the East River. A grand jury had failed to indict a crime overlord in the current city administration's war on heroin. The Russians had exploded a nuclear device. None of it seemed real. None of it seemed to matter. The air was soft and sweet. Two men with beer bellies stood outside a bakery, pitching nickels and ribbing each other. Spring trembled on the edge of summer, and in the city, summer is the season of dreams. The young man passed the flower stand, and the sound of the bad news faded. He hesitated, looked over his shoulder, and thought it over. He reached into his coat pocket and touched the something in there again. For a moment, his face seemed puzzled, lonely, almost haunted. And then, as his hand left the pocket, it regained its former expression of eager expectation. He turned back to the flower stand, smiling. He would bring her some flowers. That would please her. He loved to see her eyes light up with surprise and joy when he brought her a surprise. Little things, because he was far from rich. A box of candy, a bracelet. Once only a bag of Valencia oranges, because he knew they were Norma's favorite.
My young friend, the flower vendor said as the man in the gray suit came back, running his eyes over the stock in the handcart.
The vendor was maybe 68, wearing a torn gray knitted sweater and a soft cap in spite of the warmth of the evening. His face was a map of wrinkles. His eyes were deep in pouches and a cigarette jittered between his fingers. But he also remembered how it was to be young in the spring. Young and so much in love that you practically zoomed everywhere. The vendor's face was normally sour, but now he smiled a little, just as the old woman pushing the groceries had, because this guy was such an obvious case. He brushed pretzel crumbs from the front of his baggy sweater and thought, if this kid were sick, they'd have him in intensive care right now. How much are your flowers? The young man asked.
I'll make you up a nice bouquet for $1. Those tea roses, they're hothouse. Cost a little more, 70 cents apiece. I'll sell you half a dozen for $3.50.
Expensive, the young man said.
Nothing good comes cheap, my young friend. Didn't your mother ever teach you that?
The young man grinned.
She might have mentioned it at that.
Sure, sure she did.
I'll give you half a dozen, two red, two yellow, two white. Can't do no better than that, can I? Put in some baby's breath, they love that, and fill it out with some fern. Nice. Or you can have the bouquet for $1.
They? The young man asked, still smiling.
My young friend, the flower vendor said, flicking his cigarette butt into the gutter and returning the smile. No one buys flowers for themselves in May. It's like a national law. You understand what I mean?
The young man thought of Norma, her happy, surprised eyes, and her gentle smile, and he ducked his head a little.
I guess I do at that, he said. Sure you do. What do you say?
Well, what do you think?
I'm gonna tell you what I think. Hey, advice is still free, isn't it?
The young man smiled and said, I guess it's the only thing left that is.
You damn tootin' it is, the flower vendor said. Okay, my young friend, if the flowers are for your mother, you get her the bouquet. A few jonquils, a few crocuses, some lily of the valley. She don't spoil it by saying, oh, Junior, I love them. How much did they cost? Oh, that's too much. Don't you know enough not to throw your money around?
The young man threw his head back and laughed. The vendor said, but if it's your girl,
that's a different thing, my son, and you know it. You bring her the tea roses, and she don't turn into an accountant. You take my meaning? Hey, she's gonna throw her arms around your neck?
I'll take the tea roses, the young man said, and this time it was the flower vendor's turn to laugh. The two men pitching nickels glanced over, smiling.
Hey, kid, one of them called. You wanna buy a wedding ring cheap? I'll sell you mine. I don't want it no more.
The young man grinned and blushed to the roots of his dark hair. The flower vendor picked out 6 tea roses, snipped the stems a little, spritzed them with water, and wrapped them in a large conical spill.
Tonight's weather looks just the way you'd want it, the radio said. Fair and mild, temps in the mid to upper 60s, perfect for a little rooftop stargazing if you're the romantic type. Enjoy, Greater New York. Enjoy.
The flower vendor scotch-taped the seam of the paper spill and advised the young man to tell his lady that a little sugar added to the water she put them in would preserve them longer.
I'll tell her, the young man said. He held out a $5 bill. Thank you. Just doing the job, my young friend, the vendor said, giving him $1.25.
His smile grew a bit sad.
Give her a kiss for me.
On the radio, the Four Seasons began singing Sherry. The young man pocketed his change and went on up the street, eyes wide and alert and eager, looking not so much around him at the life ebbing and flowing up and down Third Avenue as inward and ahead, anticipating. But certain things did impinge. A mother pulling a baby in a wagon. The baby's face comically smeared with ice cream. A little girl jumping rope and sing-songing out her rhyme.
Betty and Henry up in a tree, K-I-S-S-I-N-G. First comes love, then comes marriage. Here comes Henry with a baby carriage.
Two women stood outside a washateria, smoking and comparing pregnancies. A group of men were looking in a hardware store window at a gigantic color TV with a 4-figure price tag. A baseball game was on, and all the players' faces looked green. The playing field was a vague strawberry color, and the New York Mets were leading the Phillies by a score of 6-1 in the top of the ninth. He walked on, carrying the flowers, unaware that the two women outside the washateria had stopped talking for a moment and had watched him wistfully as he walked by with his paper of tea roses. Their days of receiving flowers were long over. He was unaware of a young traffic cop who stopped the cars at the intersection of 3rd and 69th with a blast on his whistle to let him cross. The cop was engaged himself and recognized the dreamy expression on the young man's face from his own shaving mirror, where he had often seen it lately. He was unaware of the two teenaged girls who passed him going the other way and then clutched themselves and giggled. At 73rd Street, he stopped and turned right. This street was a little darker, lined with brownstones and walk-down restaurants with Italian names. Three blocks down, a stickball game was going on in the fading light. The young man did not go that far. Half a block down, he turned into a narrow lane. Now the stars were out, gleaming softly, and the lane was dark and shadowy, lined with vague shapes of garbage cans. The young man was alone now. No, not quite. A wavering yowl rose in the purple gloom, and the young man frowned. It was some tomcat's love song, and there was nothing pretty about that. He walked more slowly and glanced at his watch. It was 7:45, and Norma should be just... Then he saw her coming toward him from the courtyard, wearing dark blue slacks and a sailor blouse that made his heart ache. It was always a surprise seeing her for the first time. It was always a sweet shock. She looked so young. Now his smile shone out, radiated out, and he walked faster. Norma, he said. She looked up and smiled, but as they drew together, the smile faded. His own smile trembled a bit, and he felt a moment's disquiet. Her face over the sailor blouse suddenly seemed blurred. It was getting dark now. Could he have been mistaken? Surely not. It was Norma. I brought you flowers, he said in a happy relief, and handed the paper spill to her. She looked at them for a moment, smiled, and handed them back. Thank you, but you're mistaken, she said. My name is Norma, he whispered, and pulled the short-handled hammer out of his coat pocket where it had been all along. They're for you, Norma. It was always for you. All for you. She backed away, her face a round white blur, her mouth an opening black O of terror, and she wasn't Norma. Norma was dead. She had been dead for 10 years, and it didn't matter because she was going to scream, and he swung the hammer to stop the scream, to kill the scream, and as he swung the hammer, the spill of flowers fell out of his hand. The spill spilled and broke open, spilling red, white, and yellow tea roses beside the dented trash cans where cats made alien love in the dark, screaming in love, screaming, screaming. He swung the hammer, and she didn't scream, but she might scream because she wasn't Norma. None of them were Norma. Norma, and he swung the hammer, swung the hammer, swung the hammer. She wasn't Norma, and so he swung the hammer, as he had done 5 other times. Some unknown time later, he slipped the hammer back into his inner coat pocket and backed away from the dark shadow sprawled on the cobblestones, away from the litter of tea roses by the garbage cans. He turned and left the narrow lane. It was full dark now. The stickball players had gone in. If there were bloodstains on his suit, they wouldn't show, not in the dark, not in the soft late spring dark, and her name had not been Norma, but he knew what his name was. It was love. His name was love, and he walked these dark streets because Norma was waiting for him, and he would find her. Someday soon, he began to smile. A bounce came into his step as he walked on down 73rd Street. A middle-aged married couple sitting on the steps of their building watched him go by, head cocked, eyes far away, a half-smile on his lips. When he had passed by, the woman said, "How come you never look that way anymore?"
"Huh?"
Nothing, she said. But she watched the young man in the gray suit disappear into the gloom of the encroaching night and thought that if there was anything more beautiful than springtime, it was young love.
The Last Rung on the Ladder.
I got Katrina's letter yesterday, less than a week after my father and I got back from Los Angeles. It was addressed to Wilmington, Delaware, and I'd moved twice since then. People move around so much now. And it's funny how those crossed-off addresses and change-of-address stickers can look like accusations. Her letter was rumpled and smudged, one of the corners dog-eared from handling. I read what was in it, and the next thing I knew, I was standing in the living room with the phone in my hand, getting ready to call Dad. I put the phone down with something like horror. He was an old man, and he'd had two heart attacks. Was I going to call him and tell him about Katrina's letter so soon after we'd been in L.A.? To do that might very well have killed him. So I didn't call. And I had no one I could tell. A thing like that letter, it's too personal to tell anyone except a wife or a very close friend. I haven't made many close friends in the last few years, and my wife Helen and I divorced in 1971. What we exchange now are Christmas cards. How are you? How's the job? Have a happy new year. I've been awake all night with it, with Katrina's letter. She could have put it on a postcard. There was only a single sentence below the Dear Larry. But a sentence can mean enough. It can do enough. I remembered my dad on the plane, his face seeming old and wasted in the harsh sunlight at 18,000 feet as we went west from New York. We had just passed over Omaha, according to the pilot, and Dad said, "It's a lot further away than it looks, Larry." There was a heavy sadness in his voice that made me uncomfortable because I couldn't understand it. I understood it better after getting Katrina's letter. We grew up 80 miles west of Omaha in a town called Hemingford Home, my dad, my mom, my sister Katrina, and me. I was 2 years older than Katrina, whom everyone called Kitty. She was a beautiful child and a beautiful woman. Even at 8, the year of the incident in the barn, you could see that her corn silk hair was never going to darken and that those eyes would always be a dark Scandinavian blue. A look in those eyes, and a man would be gone. I guess you'd say we grew up hicks. My dad had 300 acres of flat, rich land, and he grew feed corn and raised cattle. Everybody just called it the home place. In those days, all the roads were dirt except Interstate 80 and Nebraska Route 96, and a trip to town was something you waited 3 days for. Nowadays, I'm one of the best independent corporation lawyers in America, so they tell me. And I'd have to admit, for the sake of honesty, that I think they're right. A president of a large company once introduced me to his board of directors as his hired gun. I wear expensive suits, and my shoe leather is the best. I've got 3 assistants on full-time pay, and I can call in another dozen if I need them. But in those days, I walked up a dirt road to a one-room school with books tied in a belt over my shoulder, and Katrina walked with me. Sometimes, in the spring, we went barefoot. That was in the days before you couldn't get served in a diner or shop in a market unless you were wearing shoes. Later on, my mother died. Katrina and I were in high school up at Columbia City then, and 2 years after that, my dad lost the place and went to work selling tractors. It was the end of the family, although that didn't seem so bad then. Dad got along in his work, bought himself a dealership, and got tapped for a management position about 9 years ago. I got a football scholarship to the University of Nebraska and managed to learn something besides how to run the ball out of a slot right formation. And Katrina? But it's her I want to tell you about. It happened, the barn thing, one Saturday in early November. To tell you the truth, I can't pin down the actual year, but Ike was still president. Mom was at a bake fair in Columbia City, and Dad had gone over to our nearest neighbor's, and that was 7 miles away, to help the man fix a hay rake. There was supposed to be a hired man on the place, but he had never showed up that day, and my dad fired him not a month later. Dad left me a list of chores to do, and there were some for Kitty, too, and told us not to get to playing until they were all done. But that wasn't long. It was November, and by that time of year, the make-or-break time had gone past. We'd made it again that year. We wouldn't always. I remember that day very clearly. The sky was overcast, and while it wasn't cold, you could feel it wanting to be cold, wanting to get down to the business of frost and freeze, snow and sleet. The fields were stripped. The animals were sluggish and morose. There seemed to be funny little drafts in the house that had never been there before. On a day like that, the only really nice place to be was the barn. It was warm, filled with a pleasant mixed aroma of hay and fur and dung, and with the mysterious chuckling, cooing sounds of the barn swallows high up in the third loft. If you cricked your neck up, you could see the white November light coming through the chinks in the roof and try to spell your name. It was a game that really only seemed agreeable on overcast autumn days. There was a ladder nailed to a crossbeam high up in the third loft, a ladder that went straight down to the main barn floor. We were forbidden to climb on it because it was old and shaky. Dad had promised Mom 1,000 times that he would pull it down and put up a stronger one, but something else always seemed to come up when there was time, helping a neighbor with his hay rake, for instance, and the hired man was just not working out. If you climbed up that rickety ladder, there were exactly 43 rungs. Kitty and I had counted them enough to know. You ended up on a beam that was 70 feet above the straw-littered barn floor. And then, if you edged out along the beam about 12 feet, your knees jittering, your ankle joints creaking, your mouth dry and tasting like a used fuse, you stood over the haymow. And then you could jump off the beam and fall 70 feet straight down with a horrible, hilarious, dying swoop into a huge, soft bed of lush hay. It has a sweet smell, hay does, and you'd come to rest in that smell of reborn summer with your stomach left behind you, way up there in the middle of the air, and you'd feel, well, like Lazarus must have felt. You had taken the fall and lived to tell the tale. It was a forbidden sport, all right. If we'd been caught, my mother would have shrieked blue murder and my father would have laid on the strap, even at our advanced ages. Because of the ladder, and because if you happened to lose your balance and topple from the beam before you had edged out over the loose fathoms of hay, you would fall to utter destruction on the hard planking of the barn floor. But the temptation was just too great. When the cats are away, well, you know how that one goes.